This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. Coming up next, it's More Talk Radio with hosts Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is human rights activist Laura Flynn, who works with the Haitian Action Committee.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
You are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday. Today is the 12th of April, 2010, and we thank you for joining us. This morning, we will have a conversation about Haiti. In January, many of you are familiar with the earthquake that impacted that nation. We'll speak this morning with a author and a person who is very familiar with the situation in Haiti. Laura Flynn is a writer based in San Francisco. She has written about Haiti. She is a member of the board of the Aristide Foundation for Democracy U.S., which supports the work of the Aristide Foundation in Haiti, which was founded by former President Aristide in 1996. That organization seeks to build real change in democracy, working with people on the margins of society. Joins us today from San Francisco, I believe. Are you there, Ms. Flynn? Good morning. We are trying to get our signal together for our interview with Laura Flynn, and we'll have that with you in a second. In January 12th, there was an earthquake that devastated the island of Haiti, and it captivated the interest of the world. But as such tragedies often happen, they caught the attention for a while and soon faded as other things became much more important in the popular media. Unfortunately, if it faded from the popular media, the suffering and the real need continues to be an issue that many people in Haiti and their advocates face. So we bring you this program as part of a continuing effort to build awareness and to encourage continued participation and work to bring relief and restoration for that island nation. Joining us this morning is Laura Flynn, who was born and raised in San Francisco. She lived in Haiti from 1994 to 2000 and remained involved in the struggle for democracy and human dignity in that country. She'll join us shortly, and we'll have a discussion about Haiti. But first, I want to say good morning to Celeste, and how are you this day?
Hello.
Oh, good. Sounds like we have Laura here. Is that you, Laura?
Yes.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm just fine. This is Celeste. I'm here with Cecil Prescott, and welcome to Portland, Oregon, and more talk radio here on KBOO Portland. Some time ago, I want to say maybe six or more years, actually, it might have been a little bit more than 6 years ago, we had a chance to speak to you regarding the Eyes of the Heart. And with all of the attention that Haiti deserves to have, but conversely is not getting, we thought it was really important to revisit the situation to find out how things are going so that people who were able and interested to assist would know how to assist and actually just to keep the hearts and minds of the people in Haiti who have struggled so hard in front of us.
Well, thanks for dedicating a show to Haiti. I think it's great. People need to stay aware and keep their eyes. People have been incredibly generous in giving donations in the immediate aftermath of the quake. In fact, the total donations work out to something like over $1,000 per earthquake victim in Haiti. But the problem is that that money is not reaching the people who need it on the ground. And those of us who've given have to go a step further to really demand that the money be spent with transparency and that it reaches the people who need it.
In a way, the fact that there are difficulties getting the money to Haiti is not surprising, given some of its history. But the truth is their history has been shrouded with, I'll say, smoke, mirrors, and lies. And so some of the reasons why the money is not reaching people may not be the reasons we think. But really briefly, I know, Cecil, you've got a brief history of some of the issues in Haiti, like such as when the revolution took place, some of the people who had been in power, and the fact that these were corrupt governments. Did you want to?
Well, maybe Ms. Flynn can bring our audience up to speed in terms of the history of Haiti. Some of us certainly have a cursory understanding of history, the First Black Republic in 1804.
The only one of freed slaves.
And also the more recent history of the U.S. involvement in Haiti over the last century or so. You are involved in the Aristide Foundation for Democracy. Perhaps you can give us an understanding of that organization and its program, and maybe more about some of the work that continues to be done by that organization today.
Okay, did you want me to talk about Haiti's history first?
Well, yeah, Haiti's history first, just so that we can come up to a point.
Okay, let me try to be brief, and if it starts getting too long, just tell me. But I think the important thing is, for people to remember the Haitian Revolution, which is the only successful slave revolution in the history of the world. And that really is the primary fact of Haiti's history, and it's shaped every event since. Essentially, the world has been punishing Haiti for that revolution ever since. And Haiti's impoverishment, I don't want to say it's completely determined by that, but it is largely a result of the isolation and the purposeful impoverishment of that nation over the past 200 years. It's not to say Haiti doesn't have its own internal problems. It absolutely does. But Haiti was the first debtor nation in the world because after the revolution, the French government forced Haiti to pay this huge onerous debt to the French landowners who had lost their land and their slaves. So they were essentially repaying the slaveholders for the loss of their human property, which is,
is ironic.
Morally repugnant and illegal. It's more than ironic.
Yes.
And to have impoverished a nation based, and Haiti didn't have a lot of choices because it was an agricultural exporter. The only way to survive, to feed its people, was to enter into trade relations with other countries. So the only way to reopen those international trade relationships was by agreeing to this debt, which took Haiti over 100 years to pay off. And actually, in the end, a U.S. bank, which is the precursor to Citibank, bought the debt, took over the debt, which then led to the U.S. occupation in Haiti in 1915. So the history is very, Haiti's current history is very much tied to its past history. That U.S. occupation that took place from 1934 laid the groundwork for an incredibly repressive, they literally created the modern Haitian military at that point. In the Quartier General, the headquarters of the Haitian military, they had pictures of all the heads of the military, and the first one is an American, the occupying force. They created the Haitian military. That military went on to dominate the country all the way through the 1990s, including, most tragically and memorably, overthrowing the first democratically elected government that Haiti had ever had, which was in 1991, when the leader of Haiti's popular movement, a liberation theologist priest, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, overwhelmingly won Haiti's first democratic election with massive participation. The military then overthrew him with direct support from the United States government. This has been pretty well documented at this point. He spent 3 years in exile in Venezuela and then in the United States, and in 1994 he was able to return to Haiti with the assistance of the United Nations and the Clinton administration, although with lots of contradictions. Lots of contradictions, lots of conditions, lots of, insisting that he not try to recoup the 3 years that he had lost while he was in exile, and pushing strongly for a lot of neoliberal economic plans that were completely unpopular in Haiti. And I would say then the next period was kind of a back-and-forth struggle between Haitians and the Haitian government trying to stand up to that, trying to resist some of those reforms, for instance, refusing to go forward with privatization, with the United States government, the World Bank, the IMF, all pushing Haiti on policies that now even those institutions seem to recognize are responsible for impoverishing the country further. Aristide was reelected. René Préval served in office from 1996 to 2001, and Aristide was then reelected in 2001. And once again, there was massive opposition to his administration from the Bush administration in this country from the day he was elected. An aid embargo was imposed on Haiti, which cut off things like money for AIDS treatment, cut off, water plans that had, that really had absolutely nothing to do with politics. And the point of that embargo was to starve the government and to put it into a position where it would be very difficult for it to resist a future coup, which is what eventually happened in 2004. The United States government, with the direct assistance of the French and Canadian governments, overthrew the government of Haiti and quite literally sent an airplane and physically removed President Aristide from the country.
And that was about the time, I think shortly after that, is when we first connected with you to promote the book, Eyes of a Heart.
Yeah.
In doing the recap, I think it's really important for people to hear this, because one of the reasons the aid has not been delivered is because of all these complications. The political party that was in power at the time, Lavalas, made a lot of strides at reducing everything from illiteracy rates to hunger to HIV rates in this country under President Aristide. And that kind of progress was not supposed to happen in Haiti. And so with the earthquake and the devastation that was wreaked, it's almost as though the powers that be that were not happy with seeing Haiti be successful have had another opportunity to bring it down, because now we've got As you said, lots of aid coming in, but it's tied up. Some of it is not even being delivered. Some of the aid from the U.S., for example, had not even been delivered.
No, I mean, what it's tied up with is Haiti's basic social apartheid situation. So you have a country, I mean, I think South Africa really is the only comparison that people can kind of make to try to understand the division, the class divisions in Haiti. You have a very small elite minority in the country who is adamantly opposed to democracy, as in one person, one vote. Every time the Haitian people voted for the person they wanted, that person's been overthrown with the assistance and the elites working with the United States government. Right now, today in Haiti, so then you have masses of people, you know, 85-90% of the population living in abject poverty and seen as really less than human by that elite group, who have always really made their money. It's sort of like if you had the mafia running the food imports mm-hmm. into a country. So they've always had a stranglehold on the economy. Well, they have a stranglehold on the aid in the same way, because there's no way, I mean, they control the ports, they control the imports, they're the ones who get the contracts, they're the ones who are going to benefit from all this aid money coming into the country. So that's one level. At another level, you also have the reality that the United States chose to militarize this aid project from the very first moment. What we saw going in were soldiers, and I think, you know, a recent report I saw said that, you know, out of every dollar spent, 40 cents by the U.S. government, 40 cents were spent on for the military. That didn't, I mean, there are a few things the military did that were helpful. One huge thing is they fixed the port, which was completely destroyed by the, you know, damaged by the earthquake to the point where ships couldn't unload. And they did fix that. So there were some things. They cleared some roads. But in general, they were sort of holding back, sitting in their camps. Well, that was incredibly expensive, but basically useless to the population of Haiti. You know, and beyond that, it was detrimental because putting them first then meant that other you know, aid organizations couldn't get through the airport. But also, it set up a whole mentality that to deliver this aid, you have to have a kind of security cordon around you at all times. I mean, I was talking to people in the weeks after the earthquake, and at the Aristide Foundation, we had 54 Cuban and Haitian doctors, young doctors, who had recently finished their training in Cuba, young Haitians, ready to work. And for over 10 days, I couldn't get any medical supplies to them whatsoever. They had thousands of people coming to the foundation wanting treatment. They didn't have Band-Aids. I mean, they had a little bit of stuff right at the beginning, and then they ran out, and they had nothing. And I could not, and I was talking to everyone, I could not, and they were a mile from the airport. I could not get anything to them. And at the same time, you had, like, you know, doctors preparing to fly in, you know, Harvard doctors preparing to fly in to perform surgeries. And you're just like, well, that's all very nice, but could we supply the country's own doctors with basic supplies to help people? You know, and those Harvard doctors, you know, would need a group of private security forces to travel with them in order to secure the area where they were going to work, and on and on and on. So you have, like, this model that's impossible. And they had basically closed down the airport, creating a kind of green zone at the Port-au-Prince airport that nobody can get into and out of. And still today, Haitians can't get in and out of the airport to go look for, you know, if you send stuff. I did get a few, a small load of medical supplies, and we've never been able to get it out of the airport. That's impossible for a Haitian organization to access. You have to have a UN ID to get into the Haitian airport. That's the only airport in the country, you know, so it's, at this point, the whole aid operation is so kind of separate from the population itself.
So
there's this massive disconnect, you know, and it's driven by fear that somehow if you go out and distribute food, you know, you're going to be attacked or there's going to be riots, so it has to be done in certain ways. Well, that isn't the experience of people who are out there working in the camps directly without any security. Haitians are actually incredibly organized in the camps, and they're able, when food gets there, you know, if things are set up in advance, people are told what's going on, it can be done incredibly smoothly.
Well, there's a lot of examples of that, and we'll touch on those in just a minute. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 here in the city. This is More Talk Radio. Please join us by calling us at 503 231-8187. Cecil?
So for some clarification in terms of the situation right now, is the U.S. military controlling what comes in and out of the country? Is the dominant political force the U.S.? Where's the Haitian government and relief organizations? How do they, where are all these players?
Well, a lot of U.S. troops have left, which I think is a really good thing. Not all, but I think there were 20,000 at the high point, and it's closer to 10,000 now. So there are a lot fewer. I don't think they're controlling the airport, you know, directly. As in, you know, for a time they were doing the flight control of the airport. I don't think that's continuing now, but they have the overwhelming power of the country. I mean, the truth for the reality for the Haitian government is that it has lost large numbers of people, certainly high-level people. I mean, all but one ministry collapsed. I mean, if you can try to imagine what it would be like to try to run a government when you've lost every single government building, and inside those buildings, a lot of your
the civil servants, yeah.
About the only thing we have that we can look at would be the destruction of New Orleans.
Yes, I think it would be similar to that, except that there's no outside, there's no rest of the country to come help you, you know,
right.
Because that is the center of the country, and Port-au-Prince is where all the food and the entire government's in Port-au-Prince, which is not a good thing. And going forward, like, one of the few good things that may come out of this is that the country's going to have to be decentralized. There's just no other way. But beyond that, there has been a kind of vacuum. I mean, the Haitian government has been crippled. There also has not been, I'll just say what people that I talk to in Haiti tell me, which is they do not feel the presence of their government. They don't feel that the government has communicated with them about what the plans are. I mean, about anything. I mean, if you take a few examples, for instance, like there were tens of thousands of bodies on the streets of Port-au-Prince. The government sent trucks out in the early days, loaded the trucks out, took them to burial grounds outside the city, and dumped them in mass graves. But there was no real communication. I mean, that was a horrible thing, and in some ways, there weren't a lot of choices about what you could do because there were so many dead, and something had to be done. They couldn't let the corpses rot in the streets. But at the same time, there was no kind of message or talk. I mean, I think it's a total communications disaster, in the sense that then you have to say, this is a choice we have to make as a people, this is a terrible thing, you know, we're going to organize mass funerals for them, we're going to do something, because it's devastating to any country. It's particularly devastating in Haiti, where you have kind of deep religious belief that if you do not properly bury someone and carry out, you know, there are things you have to do for the dead to enable them to go on to the next world, and if you don't do that, they're trapped. So that's just one example, and there are many others. You know, the government went to the UN to the UN headquarters 2 weeks ago to do this massive donors meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked for, they got $4.4 billion in pledges for rebuilding Haiti in the next couple of years. But the Haitian people have no information about what this plan is. There's no sense of, I mean, quite literally, there was no public meeting. I mean, if you can imagine doing something like that, laying out a national plan for the country and never once asking the population what they think about it. So there is a complete kind of, both the international aid organizations don't have a real kind of connection to grassroots Haitians, and the government doesn't either. And they are hobbled by what's happened to them, but I think there haven't been any signs that they want to communicate. You know, there haven't been, I mean,
right.
Members of the government have not gone out to the camps and talked to people, for instance. They haven't appeared publicly to say, I mean, if you don't have the resources, if you can't offer people food, then at least you have to offer sympathy, you know? And that's what Haitians don't feel.
At the same time, you know, the confusion over the government, there seems to be a renaissance of spirit, as you mentioned, in terms of the Haitian people. And before we go to our callers, I thought it would be helpful for you to mention some of the work that the people are doing. Maybe you've written recently about the Aristide Foundation and the Mobile Schools. Say something about that.
Yeah, let me just say a little bit about the organization I work for. I'm not being paid, but I'm a board member of the Aristide Foundation for Democracy in Haiti. And pretty much since the earthquake, I've been working full-time to support their efforts to do earthquake relief projects and also to try to be a bridge between the larger aid organization and grassroots Haitians across the city, particularly because the city is exactly where the foundation has had, I mean, we're just outside of Port-au-Prince, and we have deep, long-lasting relationships in every one of the poor neighborhoods of Port-au-Prince. And when people talk about refugee camps across the city, what we're really talking about is the displacement of those neighborhoods. There's a refugee camp in every poor neighborhood. That's who it is. It's just the people of Marquisson are now in this camp. The people of, you know, Bel Air are now in this camp. And so, each of those neighborhoods had neighborhood committees and neighborhood organizations, and that all still exists. So you have this vast network of grassroots organizers, and, you know, we're working closely and we're in touch with them. And some of the specific projects, we don't have a lot of money. We're not getting any money from any of these mainstream aid organizations for reasons I think are pretty obvious, because, you know, President Aristide is the founder of the organization, and the foundation remains a symbol of hope, and we continue to call for his return to Haiti. But we have been able to do some really amazing work, and all of that work is led by Haitians and staffed by Haitians. So we started really early on. We just said, like, oh, my God, what can we do quickly without a lot of infrastructure that would employ a lot of people and do something for kids in the camps? Because we have a long history of working with street kids and Rustavet kids, and we felt like that was somewhere we could really do something. We don't have food, and we don't have water, and we don't have money to build shelter for them, but we can be with the kids and try to accompany them in this moment. So we organized mobile schools, and we recruited young students who had been working with us at a Spanish language and computer schools. So we had this kind of great group of several hundred young Haitians who are high school and college graduates. They're all working as monitors, so teachers, in these mobile schools that we set up. And we just built open-air tents. So they're, like, you know, covered with local materials. We built tents in those in five different refugee camps. And then the kids spend 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, with the monitors doing kind of basic, you know, mostly fun stuff, activities. I mean, we don't have any books, really, but they're doing singing, dancing, talking, and there's a real kind of emphasis on trying to help the kids through the trauma of the quake. So giving them an opportunity to talk about their experiences and even to do some play therapy kind of stuff, playing out what happened and sharing the experience in some way. And then also some real basic, you know, working on letters and a little bit of reading and writing, and then a snack every day, which has been difficult to find the food donations for, but a really critical part of the project, because the horrible reality is that most of the people in the camps aren't eating. And so,
Laura, if I understand correctly, one of the things you talked about was how organized internally a lot of the people were. The fact that food is hard to come by, and people are anxious about it, but there hasn't been any problems with the food being taken from the kids.
Everybody
protects their kids, as a matter of fact.
Right, and the whole dynamic is totally different from where, you know, if you have an outside aid organization coming in and distributing food, I mean, it's totally different. What we're doing in the mobile schools is we went into the camps, and when I say we, I mean, I'm like the only American involved. It was all Haitians. Go in, talk to the families, ask them for their partnership in this program. They built the structures that the schools are in. They created committees to make sure that those structures are protected. People sleep in them at night because that's fine. I mean, they don't have anywhere to sleep. People sleep in them at night, but they're cleared out during the day because everyone wants the children to have a space to go. The same thing with the food distribution. Everyone wants the kids to get this food and for the mobile schools to be able to continue, and they understand that if you know, there's a disruption, that's not going to happen. So, we're serving about 1,260 kids in five different refugee camps across the city. It's not large in terms of the overall need and effort, but I think it shows how incredibly you know, with a lid, I mean, because this whole project is $40,000. That's what we've raised for it. And we're doing this for 15 weeks, and we're employing 107 people all together in this project.
That is incredible. And
yeah, I mean, and getting food donations. So the $40,000 doesn't count the food donations, but that's all, which to me says, with very little money, you can do so much if you really have the will and true community support for the projects you're doing. I mean, if people are willing to do that kind of grassroots work, Haitians can take care of themselves.
And we'll come back and revisit that thought here in a few minutes. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, and we've got callers who've been patient. Thank you. Thank you so much. Good morning, Ed.
Hey, good morning. What an interesting and terrible topic. I can certainly hear the frustration in your caller's voice. You know, President Clinton recently apologized for forcing free trade on Haiti because he now realizes, much too late, that it forced so many people off the land and into cities with no jobs and so on. What are your thoughts about that, and is it possible maybe to roll back so-called free trade in Haiti?
Yeah, that's a
Thank
great
you,
question.
Ed.
I mean, I think, you know, the earthquake just sort of, like, brought all of that right to the surface. It's all the critiques that those of us who've been critical of those kind of neoliberal economic policies have been making all along. And, you know, you mentioned Eyes of the Heart, the book that I edited with President Aristide. That was one of its major themes, was to call into question those practices, and specifically the destruction of Haiti's rice production industry, which is the thing that President Clinton was referring to. Basically, the United States government subsidizes rice producers in the United States, forced poor countries like Haiti to get rid of all their tariffs, and ended up completely destroying Haiti's local rice production capability, so that Haiti's a net importer of food from other countries. And in the rice category, a huge amount of rice from the United States is imported, and that's subsidized rice. So we, because we are a large and powerful country, are able to get away with subsidizing our farmers while forcing Haitian farmers, who obviously don't have the same kind of resources or advantages anyway, but forcing the Haitian government not to protect rice in its own country. And that exact thing has happened every country in the world over the past 20, 30 years, and it's happened to Mexico, and that's where all the people growing corn were forced off the land also. So it's the same dynamic. You forced all of these peasant producers off the land into the city, where they then were sitting in horribly built concrete constructions in which they died during the earthquake, and that's the bottom line. Mm. Port-au-Prince was never meant to have 2 million people, and the population density is one of the reasons that the tragedy is as bad as it is. Going forward, I think it's a huge question. I mean, I think it's possible. You know, I think it's, when I think about Haiti, what would you need to do to begin to, first of all, you would need, it wouldn't be enough just to raise tariffs and say, okay, now we're going to protect rice production, although that would help. What you would really need is a massive reinvestment in agriculture and a total commitment to protecting that industry until it regains some capacity again. In all of the sort of talk about, you know, what the multilateral institutions see going forward in Haiti, they always talk about agriculture, but I never see very much concrete on that. I mean, even Bill Clinton, like, it's kind of amazing to me. He says he's sorry and it was terrible and didn't benefit Haiti. And in the next breath, he says, but I think we can get 100,000, you know, factory labor jobs here in the next whatever couple of years. So the answer always seems to be more sweatshop jobs, you know, no matter what the question is. You know, Haiti had a coup, let's get more sweatshop jobs. Haiti had an earthquake, let's get more sweatshop jobs. And I think everybody knows that's not a viable development model, you know, that those jobs only come to Haiti by undercutting other countries like the Dominican Republic and Central America.
Well, in truth, Laura, I don't think that the idea is to really get Haiti any aid, because we have to go back to what you said earlier. Is the whole idea is that this was a country who revolted and showed that they could lead themselves, and as you aptly pointed out, they've been punished pretty much ever since. And so if their solution is always to do sweatshop jobs, this shows me that there's not really a plan to see a successful country, at least not with France and the U.S. involved. Let me put it that way.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, really, when you look at that, if they're saying more sweatshop jobs, they're just basically saying it's a slave state. I mean,
yes, that's it, exactly.
That's what it is. It's a return to that. It's like, this is what you can do. You can produce for us.
And with them becoming a protectorate, which is what the specter that's hovering over right now, it's almost full circle.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the protectorate question is, I don't know, I'm not sure the United States actually wants to take over Haiti in that way, you know, because then they're responsible, too.
So I think they
sort of like to be able to have a Haitian government to say, well, they're not, you know, like, well, don't give them any money and then blame them for what happens, you know, so there's that dynamic, too, that goes on. But the fact that coming out of this International Donors Conference, they're going to create a 16-person commission who's going to oversee all this money going into Haiti. Bill Clinton's the head of it, the Haitian the co-chairs are Bill Clinton and the Haitian Prime Minister. And eight or nine of the members are foreigners. So there are a lot of questions in Haiti. Well, obviously, is this even constitutional? Is this a complete, you know, have we completely surrendered our sovereignty at this moment? And I think at a popular level, people feel yes. The government has surrendered. And I think there was an analysis, I read of it last week, that basically said, yeah, the Haitian government just surrendered its sovereignty in exchange for promises, no actual money. You know, because that's the other thing. As weak as the government has been, they also haven't received, I think there was an analysis done by the AP saying they receive a penny of every dollar of aid actually goes to the Haitian government.
We're speaking this morning with Laura Flynn, who is a writer and has written extensively on Haiti, including editing the book Eyes of the Heart, Speaking the Path for the Poor in the Age of Globalization, with former President Aristide. She's a member of the board of the Aristide Foundation for Democracy U.S., and our numbers here are 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our next caller, Steve. Thank you for waiting.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you. No problem. Yes, recently I heard Susan Rice, a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, speaking about Haiti, and I was outraged because she said that the previous 2 years prior to the earthquake were a time of great hope. And I had heard that what was the percentage turnout in the last legislative elections due to the fact that the majority party had been banned from participation? Less than 10%?
Yes, less than 10%.
So how could that be characterized as years of hope? I thought it was just a complete outrageous lie. And also the fact that the majority party is not allowed to participate, how can that possibly be rationalized?
Well, I think, Carla, you touched on something that's important. Laura, isn't it true that a lot of the press that we get here in the States are basically just lies?
Well, yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
I mean, about Haiti.
About many things, but particularly about Haiti, the lies seem even far more distorted, and it has to do with this history, it has to do with racism, it has to do with a lot of received wisdom about, I mean, you know, basically underlying all of it, you know, well, Haitians can't govern themselves, it's a failed country, you know, I mean, they're violent, you know, those are kind of if you take most of the articles apart, that's the kind of core belief you run into. But in terms of the caller-specific question, yeah, from the point of view of the majority of Haitians who, I mean, okay, there was a recent poll done in Haiti that showed, this was before the earthquake in December, that showed that at this point, 55% of the population, when asked, said they were, you know, had a political party affiliation. That's not very high, but 45% didn't even claim any affiliation. I think that's a measure of how devastated people are by the history of, you know, having their democracy trampled on, you know, endlessly over the past 20 years. Each time they had an election, there's been a coup, or other ways of sort of co-opting whatever they've tried to do. But of the 55% who did claim an affiliation, 81% named Fami Levalas, which is President Aristide's political party, a party that over the past 6 years has been completely excluded from any participation in elections or direct participation in the government, a party that its leadership after the coup was imprisoned or forced to leave the country, and many of them are still outside the country. President Aristide isn't the only person in exile. There's also many other leaders who still cannot return to the country because it's not safe for them. But despite that, and there's also been, you know, despite that, still 81% of those claiming an affiliation claimed Sami Levalas. The next highest percentile was about 5% for Mokrena, which is a Protestant political party, very right-wing Protestant political party. But that's to give you a sense of the scale of, you know, when we say that Sami Levalas is the largest political party in the country, I mean, it's by a massive amount, even if you... I mean, that's nearly 50% of the population, with nobody else being able to really regroup any major groupings of people. So, and then to say that legislative elections were held last spring that excluded that political party, and that this past fall the government was planning to go forward with parliamentary elections were supposed to be held in February. Mm-hmm. They were canceled because of the earthquake. Presidential elections are due to be held at the end of this year.
Are you there, Laura?
Hello?
Okay, yes, we're here.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, so presidential elections are scheduled to be held at the end of the year. The two questions are, is it possible to even organize presidential elections under these conditions? And then the huge looming question is Sami Levalas going to be excluded? If so, then it's not... then it's not an election, you know. If the largest political party is going to be excluded, that we can't call that an election. So in November, you know, both the Haitian government in place and their international supporters seem to be on board with an exclusion. The question now, after the quake, is can they sustain that? And I don't think we really see the signs yet. I think probably they will attempt to continue to exclude Sami Levalas.
We're speaking this morning with Laura Flynn about Haiti. We invite your calls and emails. You may email us at moretalkradio@gmail.com. We'll go to our next caller. Good morning, George.
Well, my question is, who owns the electric company, and is there electricity? And if there is, who pays for it?
The electric company is still state-owned. And there is some electricity, and some people pay for it. A lot of people, there's a huge amount. First of all, there's not enough. There's never been coverage over the whole country. And even in the areas where there is electricity, they're not getting it 24 hours a day. There's been plans in the works for many years for the government to privatize the electric company. And I think, you know, it hasn't gone forward for lots of different reasons. There's a long history of what's called the Cumberland, which is just to connect your house to the lines without paying, and that still stands. Although at this point, after the earthquake, there is some electricity, but it's even less than it was, like maybe an hour or two a day in most areas of Port-au-Prince.
I'm wondering, as we continue to talk about Haiti and its future, for some of your reflections about what those of us in the United States can do to advocate for that nation. You mentioned, you know, there are foundations such as the foundation you are associated with, but you also mentioned the need to look at the political and economic structure and the transformation that needs to take place. What can those of us sitting in the United States do, either speaking to our congressional representatives or in terms of supporting aid relief?
Okay, well, let me take it the aid relief thing first. First of all, you know, don't give to the major aid organizations. They haven't proven that they're capable of delivering aid directly to Haitians. If you want to support grassroots direct assistance, there are a couple places you could go. One is the Aristide Foundation for Democracy, which I mentioned, and on our website, which is at aristidefoundationfordemocracy.org, there's lots more information on the work that we're doing. Another great place to look is HaitiAction.net, which is an organization out of the Bay Area that's done solidarity and support work for Haiti for 20 years, and they've raised a lot of money. They have a Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, which has raised a lot of money, and the money goes directly to grassroots organizers on the ground in Haiti. So that would be a way to do progressive relief funding. And I should say that the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund has helped the foundation a great deal. They've been really supportive of us, and I have to say thank you to them, because they have really, they were sort of in place and ready to be an answer to people who were saying, I don't want to give to the Red Cross. I want to do something, but I don't want to give to the Red Cross when I know that 60% of it's going to go to overhead and all of that. Those are some places to think of in terms of donating money. Then watching out or sort of doing some political work in terms of the aid, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti has a petition right now basically calling on the major aid organizations to be transparent and clear about their money and to include Haitian voices in their plans going forward. And you can sign on at HaitiJustice.org, you can find the petition and information. They have a couple of really great videos that were put together showing conditions in the refugee camps in Port-au-Prince, which are pretty devastating. Because I think, you know, at a mainstream level, I think people imagine somehow that Haitians are getting help because so much money was given, so they must be. Mm-hmm. But if you watch these videos, I mean, most of the people in the camps, and this is true of our experience, you know, working with the mobile schools, maybe 20% of people are getting food, you know, maybe. And, or, you know, there'll be a food delivery maybe once a week, but not even on a regular basis. And so it's, you know, it's actual near famine level of hunger that are existing in some areas of Port-au-Prince. So so I think sort of taking a human rights perspective on this and saying people have a right to this aid, especially this aid that's been given in their name, you know. So that would be one thing. And then I think beyond that, though, support for the political issues to say that elections can't go forward without the participation of the majority party. Talking to your representatives and people who, I mean, certainly trying to even raise awareness around this issue in Congress is a huge deal, to say that Haiti has to have a real democracy, that, you know, and then the call for President Aristide's return is very profound in Haiti. It gets almost no press coverage. I mean, I've seen video of people demonstrating in Haiti calling for Aristide's return, and CNN will say, you know, they're demonstrating, but they never tell you what it is they're saying.
Right.
And they'll literally cut the sound off, you know. I saw even an Al Jazeera piece where people were in front of the palace, they had photos of Aristide in their hands, and then it was a demonstration against Sarkozy, you know, the French president, when he went, and it was about reparations for, you know, trying to get back the money that the French extorted from Haiti. But they were also asking for Aristide's return, and Aristide was the person who launched that call for reparations. But they only mentioned the reparations. They're interviewing a man. He's holding a picture of Aristide in his hand, and they never mentioned that this is what the man is asking for. So it's like some kind of incredible news blackout that his name can't be mentioned somehow outside the country. But the call is pretty profound, and the call is not, I mean, he's in South Africa. He said he wants to come back. He wants to participate in the recovery of the country. He isn't saying he wants to come back as a political leader. He says he wants to work with the Aristide Foundation, with the university that he had founded, to train doctors, to help bring resources together, to help bring Haitians together at this moment when the country needs all of its children to come and help. And I think it's, you know, the international community has very little credibility with the Haitian people right now. Bringing him back would obviously shift that dramatically. They can't rebuild Port-au-Prince overnight, but they could return Aristide overnight. It could be done in a few days. And it would not change the material conditions of anyone's life in Haiti, but it would offer them some hope and some sense that they were actually going to be included in the plans going forward. And so that's why I think it's so powerfully important to echo Haitians' calls for Aristide's return. It's not a question of us asking for him to come back, but it's really echoing that really profound call in Haiti that began. I mean, it's been there since the coup 6 years ago, but after the earthquake, you know, it became really quite a profound sense of they just want him to come home.
We've talked about what the what American listeners can do, folks here in the U.S. can do. But I also wanted to talk about what other international allies Haiti may have, because on the sites that I checked, and according also to what you said, Cuba has been a help, especially in terms of medical assistance and medical training for folks. But are there any other countries who have recognized the gross inequities of Haiti's plight and are assisting, doing what they can?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Cubans are certainly on the top of the list, because from 1996, when President Aristide reopened diplomatic relations with Cuba, Cuba has played a really strong and just very concrete role in pushing forward. The doctors is the thing that's most prominent. There have been as many as 800 Cuban doctors working in Haiti at any time over the past 14 years or so. Mm-hmm. And in addition, Cuba's trained a lot of Haitian doctors in Cuba, and then they had created, along with the Aristide Foundation, a medical school in Tabar that was training Haitian doctors in Haiti with Cuban faculty. So they were supporting that initiative. But they were also involved in the National Literacy Project. They were involved in trying to help get the sugarcane industry going, in fisheries, and many, many different programs. And the difference of between their support and the sort of the international aid from Western countries is really profound. The Cubans didn't really come with any money. You know, they provide technical support and, I mean, knowledge, basically, is what they've provided. But it's the kind of knowledge that's incredibly useful to Haiti, because their experience is so much closer to Haiti's experience. Like, I think I always say, a friend of mine who was in fisheries would talk about the French had come, and they were doing this big study on, you know, the possibility of fishing in the ocean in Haiti, which obviously there are fishermen, but it's not, you know, they're not able to get that much because they don't have the resources and their boats are small. So anyway, my friend would say, yeah, the French came and spent $80,000 to do a study to tell you there's no fish in the ocean. You know, and that's kind of the experience, is that studies are done, international experts are flown in. By the time the study is finished, the political situation in Haiti has changed to the extent that whatever you were talking about doing is no longer even practical, so now you have to do a new study. And it goes on and on and on and on, and the money is wasted. I mean, Haiti has more NGOs working in it than almost any other country in the world, and it's still one of the poorest countries in the world. There are 10,000 NGOs working there. So it is not a question of having more foreigners on the ground in Haiti doing all their different projects with no coordination. One of the things with the Cubans is we worked with the Haitian government so that cooperation is very it's organized and it's thought through. It's not just, you know, a religious organization deciding to do something here in the countryside and not contacting or connecting, you know, at a national level with other groups.
So basically the whole idea is we've got Cuba, who's bringing they're bringing support in terms of hands. And then we've got the people who are there calling for a return of Aristide, because he can help them mobilize both spiritually and emotionally and mentally. And then we've got a lot of the UN-backed countries keeping a barricade, keeping a blockade, so to speak, or just a little bit of an opening to allow a small amount of aid to trickle through unless Haiti makes some concessions.
Yes, and beyond that, and then on top of that, you also have, it's not just letting the aid trickle through, but who's getting the money? You have international corporations poised with these contracts, you know, the kind of, not Blackwater, but the Blackwaters of the world, ready to be there to, you know, snap up the money. And that's both in the Haitian elite and the United States elite. So that's who's ready to pounce on the money. And, you know, they have the means to do that, to lobby, to figure out how they're going to get this money from Washington, not even from Haiti. But I do think, you know, you were asking about other countries. Cuba is one, I think, and there more solidarity with the rest of Latin America is going to be critical in Haiti going forward. And I think it's important that there are a lot of Cubans there and that a lot of people are learning Spanish, and that we try to figure out how Haiti can connect better
with the Dominicans and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dominicans for sure, with Bolivians, with you know, other progressive countries around Latin America.
Well, Laura, there's not enough time. There's so many more questions left that we'd like to ask, and so maybe we'll check back with you a little later on in the year and see how things are progressing. But you did mention a couple of websites, and then we'll unfortunately need to go. You said Haiti.
The Aristide Foundation for Democracy.org,
right,
to see the relief efforts we're doing. HaitiAction.net,
right,
has lots of information and background on Haiti. And then the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, which is IJDH.org.
Excellent.
Or actually, HaitiJustice.org, both of those work. So HaitiJustice.org.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, for your energy.
Thanks so much.
And for bringing the word out to the rest of us.
Great to talk to you.
We've been speaking with Laura Flynn of the Aristide Foundation for Democracy. And again, we remind you to check out their website and the others that were mentioned to discover what is happening and what type of help and assistance we can do for the development of that country. Let me suggest to you that you continue listening to KBOO this morning. At 9 on the OMO Variety Hour, we hear about the nation's biggest anti-poverty program, the Earned Income Tax Credit. Also, the MOES look at the solution to the capitalist ecological crisis and a commentary on how to deal with the unemployment crisis. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks with an urban farmer in the Selwood neighborhood of Portland and the owner of an urban farm store a few blocks away from the farm. And at 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Servan Schreiber discusses why not all of us will develop cancer and how we can develop a science-based anti-cancer diet lifestyle. All of this here on your community radio station, KBOO.
And we'll go out with a very short poem that was written by Danielle Legros-Georges, who was born in Haiti and is teaching in Lesley University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She sent this poem in to the Bill Moyers show, and I wanted to read it for you just to keep Haiti a light in your mind. The poem is entitled, Poem for the Poorest Country in the Western Hemisphere. O poorest country, this is not your name. You should be called Beacon and Flame, Almond and Bougainvillea, Garden and Green Mountain, Villa and Hut. Little girl with red ribbons in her hair, books under arm, charmed by the light of morning. Charcoal seller in black skirt, encircled by dead trees. You, country, are the businessman and the eager young man, the grandfather at the gates, at the crossroads, with the flashlight. With the light, with the light. Thank you for listening. This is KBOO, Portland.